Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. Today, I'm reading from the January-February 2025 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article, Rites of Winter. On the Italian island of Sardinia, carnival season revolves around nature, community, and mysterious traditions. By Jenny Rothenberg Gritz. The first time Salvatore Gungi transformed into a mama throne, he was 14 years old. He pulled on the traditional leather-soled shepherd's boots, velvet pants, and jacket, and wrapped himself in a heavy cloak. Across his chest, he strapped a cluster of bells that weighed more than 60 pounds. He felt a strange mix of emotions as he paraded through the streets, a somber mask covering his face. There was my grandpa and my mama and papa, and also my uncle, and they were so proud, recalls Gungi. More than four decades later. And yet, he adds, it was a horrible day. I was tired and scared because it was such a long parade. I remember my feeling was, I can't do it anymore. I can't. But I carried on. The parade of Malmothones is an annual winter tradition in the Italian village of Mamoida. The village of around 2300 is in the heart of Sardinia, an Italian island about 175 miles from the mainland. By comparison, Sicily is only 2 miles from the mainland. While Italian is the island's official language, Sardinians also speak a separate Latinate language that most Italians struggle to understand. In villages like Mamoida, just about all the income is related to either agriculture or tourism. The parade of Malmothones is one of the largest tourism draws of the entire year, even though it isn't especially cheerful. It's a serious and in some ways sad carnival, Gungi told me. This is not like a theater for making people happy. If the phrase Italian carnival brings to mind a cast of playful characters, Harlequin with his multicolored diamonds, Perrault with his oversized buttons, the plague doctor with his bird-like beak, you're probably thinking of Venice. The first recorded carnival took place there in 1094. The festival had a Christian tie-in as a burst of hedonism before the austerity of Lent. The word carnaval means taking out the meat, implying one last decadent feast. The celebration may also have older pagan roots. During the Roman festival of Saturnalia, ancestors of today's Italians drank and indulged and turned the social order upside down. Masters served their slaves, and an elected, quote, king gave orders to everyone. Throughout the Middle Ages, carnivals popped up all over Europe, and later spread across the ocean in New Orleans and Rio de Janeiro. European Jews may well have been influenced by these pre-Lent festivals when they turned the late winter holiday of Purim into a night of costumes, theatrics, and topsy-turvy hierarchies. The festival of Malmothones is not part of the same carnival tradition, though it has its own Christian association. It starts on the eve of January 17th, the feast day of St. Anthony the Abbot, a legendary saint who had an austere life in the wilderness and lived to be 105. But this is a pagan festival, Gungi told me. Everybody knows it has nothing to do with Christianity. It's unclear when the parade originated or what the word Malmathone even means, but the character itself has a distinct appearance. The most startling part of the costume is the mask, with its severe and labored expression. Another set of characters, called Isohadores, literally rope-bearers, march along with the Malmathones, slinging lassos. The Isohadores wear a different mask, blankly white and unsmiling. In an email, Elena Giangulio and Alice Mida, the scientific director and assistant director of Malmoda's Museum of Mediterranean Masks, explains that the parade belongs to a tradition of festivals that are profoundly serious and solemn, unlike the modern carnival, which is lighthearted and fun. There are other winter parades like this in villages throughout Europe. In the Portuguese Entrudo Festival, the locals wear terrifying masks and chase people through the streets. In some German-speaking villages, people celebrate Kampfusnacht, or the Night of the Krampus, with a devil-like figure who roars at children and threatens to carry them away in his sack. Heavy, clanging cowbells are a theme at many of these events, all of which are less about merriment than exercising the forces of evil, as the museum directors put it. The somber procession of the Malmathones may have its roots in the neurotic civilization, which began almost 4,000 years ago. In Venice, Rio, and New Orleans, outlandish disguises give revelers a chance to flaunt their individuality. But in Mamoida, there's a striking uniformity, as rows of Malmathones and Isohadores parade together wearing the same two masks. Instead of upending the social order, the Sardinian carnival seems to reinforce it. "We feel like we're in a trance," Gunji told me. "We don't look at the other people. It's just about all of us together as a group." The Malmathones and Isohadores come out three times each winter. Two of those times are scheduled to coincide with the traditional Italian carnival season, the Sunday and Tuesday before Lent. Those performances are tourist events geared toward the public, as villagers march during the daytime along the town's main road. But the initial event is much more intimate. On the eve before January 17th, the Malmathones and Isohadores weave through the whole village at night, circling dozens of bonfires. Villagers spend weeks ahead of time collecting roots and stumps for these blazes. Then they gather around them to roast pigs and share one another's company. The holiday gives the community a chance to make sure all their relations are good, Gunji explained. Their livelihood depends on it. All throughout the year, Sardinian villagers work together in cooperatives, tending their vineyards and olive orchards and raising pigs for ham and salami. When one farmer needs help, the others pitch in. Everybody knows how much is at stake. I got a glimpse of this in mid-September when Gunji sent me a message apologizing that he had to postpone our planned phone conversation. The forecast was predicting a big storm, he explained, and he and his neighbors needed to quickly harvest their grapes, or they'd lose a year's work. He elaborated when we spoke a few days later. "The weather rules everything," he said. "Lately, with the changing climate, summers have become hot and dry. No rain at all for 6 months. Everything was suffering. When the rain does come now," he went on, "it's no normal rain. It's like a tropical rain. When January arrives, people are more anxious than ever about the upcoming growing season. Can you imagine how we feel about the weather? He asked. It's not like in a city, where you put up an umbrella and everything is all right. Gunji has some experience with cities and umbrellas. As a younger man, he spent a few years in Wales and London, working as a carpenter. It was an easier life in some ways, but especially when the seasons changed, he felt the pull of his native landscape. Sardinia is known as a blue zone, one of five spots on the globe where people live an unusually long time. That could be partly because Sardinians naturally live according to guidelines for longevity that doctors recommend. They eat locally and cherish their communal gatherings. I missed it a lot, Gunji said. I took all my holidays in January just to make sure I could have a role in the festival. Gunji has dressed up as a mammothone just about every year since he was 14, apart from the festival's one-year hiatus during COVID-19 lockdowns. He only missed a couple of years, and the last of those was a quarter century ago. There are men as old as 80 who still strap on the furs and the heavy bells, hiding their faces behind those gloomy masks. Whether or not they're banishing evil spirits and appeasing the forces of nature, their survival feels tied to this ritual, its power, its clamor, its sense of connection. I intend to carry on, Gunji told me, until I can't anymore. That's the end of the article. Smithsonian senior editor Jenny Rothenberg-Gritz last wrote for the magazine about descendants of Black Civil War heroes. And she's the author of the article, Rites of Winter. This next article is titled The Enduring Spirit of Butler Island. In Georgia, descendants of people enslaved on an infamous plantation struggle to preserve the site's complicated history and honor the region's rich culture. It's by Melissa Cooper. The route that runs straight through Darien, Georgia, and cuts across the marshes, rivers, and creeks along coastal McIntosh County leads to a historic site, Butler Island, a once vast antebellum plantation. Drivers unfamiliar with this stretch of U.S. Highway 17 likely pay little attention to the remains of a 75-foot brick chimney that powered the old rice mill or the huge kiln nearby, both planted in the lush landscape of palmetto trees and marsh grass. The 1,500-acre Tidewater plantation was originally purchased in 1793 by Major Pierce Butler, a signer of the United States Constitution, whose grandsons, Pierce Meese Butler and John Meese Butler, inherited the property and the people enslaved there. Relying on agricultural knowledge passed down to them by their ancestors who honed their techniques in West Africa's rice-growing region, stretching from present-day Senegal to Liberia, the captives on Butler Island waded through boggy and marshy fields, doing intensive, grueling work to produce the rice crop that made coastal planters rich. Today, all that remains to acknowledge the hundreds who maintained the residence and worked the land is a historical marker erected in 2019 that shares a brief story of the, quote, enslaved people of Butler Island. Dehumanization and suffering were inherent effects of slavery, and some of the agonies Butler Island's enslaved population endured were documented by Frances Ann Kemble, Pierce Meese Butler's wife, a well-known British actress who spent the winter of 1838-39 on the plantation. The couple typically resided in Philadelphia. Absent any detailed testimonies from Butler Island's enslaved residents, Kemble's record singularly sheds light on the everyday conditions there. She recalls the pitiful sight of black women in the property's infirmary, most of them on the ground, some too ill to rise. Kimball was stunned into the realization that here in their hour of sickness and suffering lay those whose health and strength are spent in unrequited labor for us, those who perhaps even yesterday were being urged on to their unpaid task. Kimball became an outspoken abolitionist, which reportedly played a role in her 1849 divorce from Butler. Through it all, the enslaved individuals on the Butler's plantation made families and a community, passing on what remained of their forebears' traditions, such as hand-weaving baskets used to winnow rice, through the generations and adding more than captivity and suffering to the meaning of the place. That's what made the events of March 2nd and 3rd, 1859, especially catastrophic. To pay off gambling debts and financial losses, Pierce Meese Butler sold 436 black people, a portion of those he enslaved on Butler Island, along with some from his nearby Hampton Plantation, a major cotton-producing farm. The auction of enslaved people held at Ten Brock Racecourse in Savannah was among the largest in American history. Anne C. Bailey, a historian and the author of a book about the auction, writes that the mass sale and its aftermath came to be known as the Weeping Time, ripping apart families and the community forged on the island, and scattering some of its members across the South. Moreover, not only did the Butler auction represent a traumatic breach in family bonds for those who were bought and sold, Bailey writes, but it also severed a link between present and future generations. After the Civil War, the Butler Island Plantation would never again achieve the same scale of agricultural production. The Butler estate was passed down in the family until it was sold in 1923, becoming a vegetable and dairy farm before changing hands again. Today, the island is the property of the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. Descendants of those who remained on Butler Island after the auction consider it a sacred place for ancestral remembrance. Down every road in McIntosh County, there is some history, says Eunice Moore, an 85-year-old lifelong Darien resident who believes her ancestors were once enslaved on the Butler Island Plantation. A former member of Darien's city council and a representative on a local historic preservation board, Moore has advocated to keep Butler Island's history alive. She is a regular honored guest at local black history events and commemorations, dressed in African-style attire that she says pulls my culture to me. For residents descended from people enslaved on Butler Island and other low country plantations, the customs of their ancestors are instilled in their culture. They point to hand-woven sweetgrass and palmetto baskets, rice fanners, intricately crafted fishing nets, musical customs such as the ring shout, which is singing spirituals while keeping the rhythm by pounding a stick and marching in a circle. Spiritual traditions such as baptismal seeking rituals and patterns of speech and syntax that could all be traced back to African influences and a culture sometimes known today as Gullah Geechee. Amy Lotson Mitchell, another coastal Georgia native, has been a key figure in preserving local black history. She calls herself a memory keeper. Born and raised in St. Simons, a nearby island settled by members of the emancipated black community from local plantations, Mitchell is now the historian for the St. Simon's African American Heritage Coalition. She was instrumental in saving the historic Harrington School, a one-room structure built on St. Simon's in the 1920s to serve three black communities. A few years ago, she published a book co-written with historian Patrick J. Holliday, Gullah Geechee Heritage in the Golden Isles. The old rice plantation on Butler Island also has personal significance for Mitchell. Her paternal ancestors are from McIntosh County and may have been enslaved there. She says all black Americans, not just those with family ties to the plantation, should learn about it. Our people need to know what struggle we had. For the communities around Georgia's coast, the struggle continues as efforts to preserve local history have grown urgent. Residents face increasing challenges, not the least of which is their displacement. The encroachment of developers and the heirs property crisis, which is marked by the forced sales of family homesteads passed down without a will, make the future of these culturally rich areas uncertain. Tax hikes and new proposed zoning regulations may also drive out residents hoping to preserve the area's history. Other dangers also threaten these historically significant sites. In 2020, a bill put forward in the Georgia State Legislature would have opened Butler Island and other heritage sites statewide to private sale. One proposal, which would have turned the plantation into a distillery, was protested by Butler Island descendants and preservation groups, including the recently formed Coalition to Save Butler Island Plantation and House. Moore was among those who fought against the sale. The bill died in the state Senate. Then last summer, the 1920s-era mansion on the site was set on fire, allegedly by a burglar, and destroyed. Meanwhile, intensifying and damaging storms are battering coastal neighborhoods, and rising seas threaten to submerge Butler Island and other heritage sites. But Moore, Mitchell, and other leaders refuse to lose faith, vowing to continue to keep the memory of their ancestors alive. "Some of these things we can't erase," says Moore. "You might want to cover them up, but you can't erase it. It's still there." That completes the article. Title was "The Enduring Spirit of Butler Island" by Melissa Cooper. This article is titled "American Culture" by David Levine. The year was 1916, and Jacob Weisel, owner of the Monroe Cheese Company of Monroe, New York, had a problem. Some of the wheels of Swiss cheese made in his factory in Pennsylvania inevitably broke or were misshapen, leaving a plethora of bits and blocks of cheese that Weisel was desperate to salvage. He had this waste shipped back to Monroe, where the solution was concocted by one of his cheesemakers, a casein culture genius named Emil Fry. On his home stove in Monroe, Fry spent 2 years tinkering. His breakthrough came in 1918 when he devised a new way to mix the cheese pieces with whey, the leftover liquid from milk curds, while adding an ingenious emulsifier to blend the fats and water. Frey patented a key part of this process. The result was a cheese that, when melted, became a smooth, velvety sauce. Frey dubbed it Val Vita, and it became an instant hit. By 1923, Weisel had incorporated the Velveeta Cheese Company and was selling his new, sensationally satiny cheese to restaurants and hotels across America and Europe. As industrial agriculture rose in the 1920s, Big Cheese soon took over. Kraft Foods bought the Velveeta Company in 1927 and Borden absorbed the Monroe Cheese Company in 1929. Kraft soon changed the Velveeta recipe, though, crucially replacing real cheese, which has only three or four ingredients, with the paragraph of chemical elements that still graces the package today. In the 1930s and 40s, Kraft began marketing Velveeta successfully, if rather dubiously, as a health food and diet aid, and its low price and convenience, beloved by kids, shelf-stable, melts like a dream, charmed America's homemakers throughout the suburban 60s and beyond. The New York Times in 1976 declared Velveeta a worldwide favorite, although no country could vie with the U.S. for sheer consumption. In 1996, domestic sales hit an astonishing peak of 8.75 pounds for every American. Perhaps Velveeta's most remarkable moment was the devastating cheese collapse of 2014. That's when Kraft announced a Velveeta shortage just ahead of the Super Bowl. "If this is true, I'm going to die," one queso-loving fan tweeted, revealing a feverish love for a cheese product that, in fact, technically does not contain cheese. That's the end of the article, American Culture, by David Levine, and that ends the program for today as well. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I've been reading from the January-February 2025 issue of the Smithsonian. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.